ज्ञानचमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानजनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीतां येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टां स्थापितां येन भूतले स्वयां रूपकदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यरेव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण कृष्ण हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 16, Text Number 4. It's prose. I'm just going to read the translation in purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation. The great Rishi Shukadeva Goswami said, "My dear King, there is no limit to the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's material energy. This material world is a transformation of the material qualities, sattva guna, rajo guna, and tamo guna. Yet no one could possibly explain it perfectly, even in a lifetime as long as that of Brahma. No one in the material world is perfect, and an imperfect person cannot describe this material universe accurately, even after continued speculation. O King, I shall nevertheless try to explain to you the principal regions such as Bhu, Goloka, with their names, forms, measurements, and various symptoms. Purport. The material world is only one-fourth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's creation, but it is unlimited and impossible for anyone to know or describe, even with the qualification of a life as long as that of Brahma, who lives for millions and millions of years. Modern scientists and astronomers try to explain the cosmic situation and the vastness of space, and some of them believe that all the glittering stars are different suns. From Bhagavad Gita, however, we understand that all these stars, nakshatras, are like the moon and that they reflect the sunshine. They are not independent luminaries. Bhuloka is explained to be that portion of outer space through which the heat and light of the sun extend. Therefore, it is natural to conclude that this universe extends in space as far as we can see and encompasses the glittering stars. Srila Shukadeva Goswami admitted that to give full details of this expansive material universe would be impossible, but nevertheless he wanted to give the king as much knowledge as he had received through the parampara system. We should conclude that if one cannot comprehend the material expansions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one certainly cannot estimate the expansiveness of the spiritual world. The Brahma Samhita 5.33 confirms this. Advaita achutam anadimanantarupam adyam purana purusham navayovanam cha. The limits of the expansions of Govinda, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, cannot be estimated by anyone, even a person as perfect as Brahma, not to speak of tiny scientists whose senses and instruments are all imperfect and could not give us information of even this one universe. We should therefore be satisfied with the information obtained from the Vedic sources as spoken by authorities like Shukadeva Goswami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. That's the basic essence probably of the chapter for many of us. And certainly of this purport, the last sentence. We should therefore be satisfied with the information obtainable from Vedic sources as spoken by authorities like Shukadeva Goswami. This is the essence of all the descriptions we're about to hear. We should be satisfied with the descriptions coming from Vedic sources and Vedic authorities. The verse is talking about the material energy is expansive and incomprehensible. What to speak of this, the spiritual world being incomprehensible, the material world itself is also incomprehensible. It cannot be perfectly explained by anyone. Even persons with powerful intelligence, like various scientists and philosophers, they cannot perfectly explain the material world either. Therefore, their theories do change often, or over periods of centuries sometimes, if not within a short lifetime, and over periods of time, theories change, new information comes. In fact, they glorify it as being science is self-correcting, which is like a clever way of saying it's wrong, an indirect way of saying it was incorrect. It's self-correcting, because you can't perfectly describe the material energy. It is incomprehensible, even for the greatest entity like Lord Brahma, who assembles the material energy. That he assembles the material energy, he cannot perfectly understand it. In fact, he gets bewildered by it as well. So what to speak of tiny scientists and astronomers and philosophers? They cannot perfectly understand the material world either. So Sukadeva Goswami is admitting here that he would not be able to perfectly explain it, because that's impossible. But he will just give him information as he has acquired it from the Parampara system. Some things here might really tackle the faith of an individual, like Prabhupada speaking about the stars reflecting the light of the sun. And I guess maybe science, modern science, they might present a different idea than that. And so devotees get bewildered. Well, modern science says this, and Prabhupada says this, and that contradicts, and I have more faith in the scientists. Generally, that's what happens. During Prabhupada's lifetime, there was, who was that devotee's name? It begins with Purushottam Prabhu, I think his name was Purushottam Prabhu. And when Prabhupada wrote this fifth canto, it was very controversial. Many devotees fell down after the fifth canto was made. And Prabhupada was describing how the moon was further away than the sun, and that the scientists never went to the moon. And Purushottam, he was, I think at the time, he was Prabhupada's personal servant, or he had a lot of close proximity to Prabhupada, at least. And that was very difficult for him to tolerate. And Prabhupada used to crack jokes at him. And one time, I think Purushottam was making like some type of preparation or something. I don't remember. It's described in the Lilamrita, I believe. And something exploded, and it kind of got all over Purushottam. And Prabhupada kind of like joked, maybe he came from the moon, you know. Prabhupada used to do things like that, like poke him, you know. And eventually he ended up leaving on account of not being able to overcome his faith in modern science and what Prabhupada was saying. And Prabhupada even at one point said, don't believe me, believe the Vedas. But devotees didn't have strong faith in the Vedas. They're neophytes, means their faith is weak, komala shraddha. Komala means pliable or weak faith, so therefore easily deterred by these types of things, which are kind of inconsequential in one sense, because our foundation of our line of thought is that consciousness is different from matter. So even someone comes up with various theories about the material energy, it's ultimately superfluous and inconsequential in the ultimate sense, because the soul is different from matter. What difference does it make? It's like if you come up with a good theory in your dream about how the dream reality is existing, but ultimately what difference does it make? You wake up from the dream. So then there might be some credibility to the various theories on a relative level. There's theories of evolution and various scientific theories. There could actually be some credibility to them. I mean, the scientists should be given credit in terms of whatever they are able to explain, although imperfectly, but explain of the material energy. Credit can be given them, but ultimately, from a philosophical perspective, it really doesn't make any difference. In one sense, it's really just a waste of time, because ultimately you die. And what our line of thought is that the soul is different from matter, and it's quite interesting that modern scientists have nothing to say about I shouldn't say they have nothing to say, but there is no consensus about what is consciousness itself. The tiniest unit of spirit, the individual soul, is practically phantomless from the modern science. The tiniest unit of spirit, namely the living entity, is completely phantomless for modern science. So what to speak of the material world, they have very imperfect explanations of the material world. They can hardly begin to understand or explain a spiritual reality when the tiniest unit of the spiritual reality is totally phantomless for them, namely consciousness. So we, as devotees, we should focus in more on that reality, the spiritual reality, because that's where we want to go. The material information about the material energy is useful for understanding how it's acting upon our consciousness so that we can understand how to release our consciousness from the various influences of the material energy. But ultimately, the various detailed descriptions are superfluous, are unimportant in terms of what we're trying to actually achieve by being devotees of Krishna and going back home, back to Godhead. What difference does it make if the sun is 93 million miles away, or, you know, 80 million miles away? I don't know what's the, something like 93 million miles. I remember reading, I think, in an astronomy book. Okay, and then suppose the Veda says it's 65 miles away. It's something just like completely far out and unbelievable and obviously not true. What difference does it make? How does that impact our understanding of consciousness? The modern science is usually, or advancement of life is usually taken in terms of our ability to dominate material nature. Therefore, most people are under the impression that we are advancing because we have been able to apparently dominate material energy more than we ever have been before. We can transcend some of the restrictions placed upon us by nature, such as like flying. We can't fly as human beings. But now modern science has created airplanes, so we've overcome the restrictions of nature upon us, and so on. In this way, people take this as evidence of our advancing civilization. Advancement is taken in terms of our ability to dominate nature. But unfortunately, we haven't been able to prove that such domination is actually improving this subjective person, that the actual being is being improved because of this. In fact, when you see all the school shootings, the kids being kidnapped and sold into prostitution and other sorts of horrible things, and so on, then we might actually question, is this advancement useful for us? Because on the subjective level, it seems that we're degrading more and more and more. So it seems more important to put our focus in on how our consciousness is evolving rather than various detailed facts about the material energy, which is, in the ultimate issue, illusory because it's an expansion of the Maya Shakti and therefore kind of superfluous. So Prabhupada's final statement is that we should put our faith in the Vedas. This is the most important point, is that you'll discover that by reason, hardly anything is concluded by reason alone. That's the interesting thing about reason. Many times, no one ever comes to a conclusion just through reason alone. Just take the atheism versus theism debates that have been going on. The atheists present various reasonable arguments based on logic. The theists also present various reasonable arguments based on logic. And on reason alone, there's no conclusion. It's just like someone is psychologically disposed this way or that way. But no one is actually usually going one direction or that based on reason alone. It's usually based on some type of predisposed psychological disposition, or what we call prejudice that's accumulated. But no one is really coming to a conclusion based on reason alone. So ultimately, it is faith that allows us to enter into these subject matters and gain from them. If we try to understand the subject matters with our puny intelligence, we find ourselves bewildered. Krishna says that the senses are higher than the sense objects. The mind is higher than the senses. The intelligence is higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. So that means if you try to understand the soul or God, which is taking this step further, just through the intelligence, you'll be repelled. Because the soul and God is higher than the intelligence. So God and the soul can't be brought to court and analyzed by reason alone. In other words, reason cannot reveal that which is higher than itself. The mind cannot reveal the intelligence. The senses cannot reveal the mind. Or you could say, the senses cannot know the mind. or the mind cannot know the intelligence, so also the intelligence cannot know the soul. Reason will be repelled ultimately. So you enter into these subject matters by faith, actually, and not by any other factor. Of course, faith is usually thought of as a departure from reason. And that way, people tend to think that they have no faith. My things are based on knowledge, whereas religion is based on faith. But actually, a word that might be synonymous with the word faith is conviction. Whatever is guiding your convictions is a type of faith. Krishna says that the soul is made of faith, or he is his faith. Shraddha Ayam, what is that? Shraddha Maya Ayam Purusha. In chapter 17, Krishna says the soul is composed of faith. So faith is the animating quality of the living entity. Where there is faith, there is movement. Where there is suspicion, there is suspension. I heard this recently. Where there is suspicion, there is suspension, isn't it? Suppose when you're getting on the airplane and you're suspicious about the pilot, you know, sanity. He looks like he's a little suicidal or something. There's just that doubt comes in the mind. Then as soon as that doubt comes, there's suspension. I think I'll take the next flight, you know. Immediately, there can't be movement when there's doubt. So where there is movement, there's faith. When there is movement in a certain direction or a certain line of thought, that means there is faith there. So faith is not a departure from reason. Faith is the very essence of the living entity. Whatever direction he's moving, he is actually demonstrating his faith. In other words, the word faith is a little bit different from the word belief. Generally, the two are considered synonymous now. You can believe in something without having to pursue it. But that's not the way the Vedic culture sees faith. Where our practical activity is an actual demonstration of our faith, which direction we're moving, the line of thought we're preaching or adhering to. It is actually a demonstration of our shraddha or our faith. Shraddha, in fact, it means where you put the heart, or you place the heart. So we are to enter into these subject matters with faith and not with intellect. It's not that the intelligence is shut off, but with the understanding that it cannot be perfectly explained, which probably means it cannot be perfectly understood. If it can't be perfectly explained, it probably can't be perfectly understood either. And therefore, ultimately, it is faith that has to guide our movement through the shastras, or through knowledge of any kind, in fact. It is faith that has to actually guide the movement, especially when you're entering into the world of spirit or the subjective reality. So Prabhupada says like that. That's his final statement here. That we should therefore be satisfied with the information obtainable from Vedic sources as spoken by authorities like Shukadeva Goswami. It is on the strength of our faith in Shastra, the Vedas, and Vedic authorities here. So two things, the Vedas and the Vedic authorities. It is on the strength of our faith in Vedas and Vedic authorities, and also our knowledge of what they say, that determines our adhikar for further advancement. It is not our adherence to the sensibilities of materialistic people that determines our advancement in spiritual life. Sometimes we become overly concerned with the perception of the materialistic society towards our personal views or our approach to spirituality. And then we think that by such sensitivity we're going to make advancement, but that's not mentioned anywhere in the shastras, that we make advancement by being sensitive to the rascal public, Prabhupada's language. Prabhupada said that we're not here to satisfy the rascal public. We're here to satisfy Krishna. This does not mean to say that they're not living entities and they're therefore not worthy of respect. By dint of being part and parcel of Krishna, they are worthy of the greatest respect offered. But it has to be admitted that they're averse to Krishna, either in piety or in sinful activity. Both are considered a type of impiety. So being overly sensitive to the averse living entities in terms of our understanding of scripture or our approach to spirituality is not a qualification for further improvement. It doesn't mean that Krishna is going to be very pleased with us just because we were sensitive to their sensibilities. Otherwise, all the various atheists who do philanthropy and altruism of all kinds will be making all sorts of spiritual advancement, but they're not. The adhikar that's mentioned in the scriptures for making advancement is our faith in Vedas and Vedic authorities, and then our subsequent knowledge of what they say. And then, of course, probably following that as well, that actually determines the qualification for advancement. And to the degree you have faith in that and knowledge, then you're called as a Kanishta, a Madhyama, or Uttama, Adhikari. Adhikari means eligibility for further development. Not like Uttama Adhikari means the topmost realized individual, but he has the greatest eligibility for further advancement. To the degree our faith and knowledge is weak, to that degree we are undeveloped and also don't have eligibility for further advancement. So sometimes the Shastras say things that are bewildering, like the stool of animals is impure, but the stool of a cow is considered, you know, sacred. You can even clean the altar with it. So that seems to be a contradiction. But then where's our faith? And what is being said there by the Supreme Lord himself? Or other factors which may directly affect the environment, like our kirtan. Kirtan, for example, not just chanting the holy names of Krishna loudly, which is the prescribed methodology for advancement in Kali Yuga, but also what we preach, directly affects the environment. It is mentioned by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta as the offensive approach to the material energy. You can go on the offense or the defense. So the defense is kind of like japa. Japa is defense. Get insulated from the attacks of maya. Japa is defense, and kirtan is offense in the material energy, making an offense. Not an offense as such to the people or something like that, but on the offense. So it directly affects the environment naturally because it's an offensive approach towards maya. So sometimes it will be found that our kirtan will be disturbing to others on account of them being in maya. And of course ourselves even being in maya as well. It might be even disturbing to us in certain circumstances. That doesn't mean it's wrong, and because it is in line with the shastras. And although devotees who are less mature may not be having a proper approach always, but they're on the right track because they're following the prescription given by the Vedas. And where there's an impropriety in their application, then those who are more mature or senior are to give them direction. And to the degree they have faith in such persons, then they can give them direction also. That point has to be considered. So it is faith alone that makes us qualify for development. Faith in what the Vedas actually are telling us to do and so on. We may have our Vyavaharika consideration. Vyavaharika means a conventional consideration based on the environment that we're living. But that can't be the final or conclusive understanding of anything. Therefore, whenever we speak something, we're supposed to confirm it by what the Shastra says or show the line of thought in Shastra. We can't just come up with a particular, some information from the mundane world and take that as the final conclusion. It may be something worth our consideration, though, in light of the bigger picture. No doubt, it's not that, just like we might take gold from a dirty place. So these things might be important in light of, just like, for example, health. There may not be great details of information in the Bhagavatam about how to keep a healthy body. So you may take information from those who know health and so on and take various recommendations like that. But that doesn't mean that that is more important than the idea that Krishna is the final protector or nourisher as such. We may take medicine as a practical consideration of trying to take care of the property Krishna has given us, namely the material body. But finally, it is Krishna who is protecting. And although such remedies may have a temporary effect, this is Prahlad Maharaj's statement, If a person is neglected by the Lord, they have no ultimate value. And therefore, you see, medicine doesn't always work, or a boat is not always able to carry a person over the ocean, or parents are not always able to protect their children. That's the examples Prahlad Maharaj gives in his prayers. So we have to, when we are having struggles with some of the statements that we hear about in the Shastras, we need not conclude that because the Shastra statements are wrong and I've been able to understand them by my intelligence, which is very feeble in its understanding of things. But rather, we may have to reevaluate what is the strength of our faith. Where there is faith, there is surrender. In fact, the two words are used synonymously by acharyas. Shraddha and Sharanagati are considered, Sharanagati is considered the external expression of Shraddha. So then, to the degree we find ourselves lacking in surrender, to that degree we can understand we're faithless, actually. And because we're chanting and we're doing some type of sadhana and so on, so we obviously have some faith. But to the degree that we have doubts in some of the various conclusions of the shastras and what the Vedic authorities say, to that degree we understand that we're faithless. And that we need to associate with those who have shraddha in order to augment our own faith. And of course, by deepening our study of the shastras also, that is mentioned in Nectar Devotion, that also helps us to nourish our faith in Krishna consciousness. You know, I find it quite hilarious many times when people quote the shastras, they're kind of like brought down or sometimes ridiculed as, well, you know, you can quote the shastras to justify anything. But then they'll start quoting all sorts of persons from the material world as if that's a higher consideration. So that always used to kind of crack me up. I remember having a discussion with one devotee like that. I wrote a particular heavy letter about something. So I quoted a whole bunch of shastra to, you know, show my line of thought like that. It was a genuine concern, but maybe the speech, and I also put that in the mail, that the speech may be a little bit off. But it was a genuine concern, so I wrote like that. And then, actually it was to Maharaj. It wasn't, the letter wasn't to him, but he came to know of it later. So he told me that, you know, you have to consider your speech. And so I quoted a verse, from the Shah, above it, Atyapi, that even if imperfectly composed, it is sung, heard, and accepted by those who are thoroughly honest. So I said, I know that my manner of presentation was not perfect. I said, no doubt I could have been expressed in a more perhaps eloquent way or more gentle way and so on. But the situation was such that I felt I should take this position. And I quoted this verse to substantiate my claim. And the Maharaj told me, you know, you can quote anything, you can find any justification in the shastras for your point. And which is true. But then I argued, I said, but you cannot quote shastra also and depend on logic to justify anything also. So which one are we supposed to do? And Maharaj saw that I was being very stubborn. I've never been like that with him. That was the first and only time I've been like that. I was being a little stubborn. I said, which one are we supposed to accept though? And so Maharaj said, okay, you know. We'll go to another topic for now. He didn't get back to me on that one, that point. But the point is that's a fact. We are to show our line of thought in the shastra. And of course, because of immaturity, so it has to be refined through higher level sangha. Not only will our understanding be refined, but our faith will also be improved before we go on quoting all sorts of material authorities to justify some rather inconsequential points about the distance of the moon from the sun or from the earth and so on. So faith is most important in moving forward in anything. As I said, the soul is his faith. That's what Bhagavad Gita says. Where there is movement, there is shraddha. Where there is non-movement, there is no faith. That's the very easy way to understand where is my faith actually lie. You can just look at your own movements throughout your life, and that will itself determine the type of shraddha that you're having and subsequent surrender. So that's all I'm going to say on that. Does anyone want to say anything or add anything to the... Yeah.
I want to add something that regarding that evidence like the Madhvacharya, he has described that out of all evidences, you know, out of all evidences,
yeah,
that Shruti means the revelations,
yeah,
by Vedic authorities means, so that is the most effective. So that is the highest evidence to listen from the authorities.
Of course, that's nice. That's Madhvacharya's. I haven't read his work, so I don't know what is his final conclusive opinion. Of course, for Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we follow primarily Jiva Goswami, who's our Tattvacharya. And he says that Bhagavatam is the topmost authority. And it can actually be argued that Bhagavatam is itself a type of Shruti, because in the beginning of the Bhagavatam we hear that it's the Shruti Saram. The essence of the Shruti is the Bhagavata. And in the Tattva Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami shows in various ways why the Bhagavatam is a more complete understanding of the Shruti. He quotes various literatures and so on to substantiate his point. So I don't know if Madhavacharya says that, but for Gaudiya Vaishnavas, Bhagavatam is the highest authority. We take and Krishna says, Tasma Shastram Pramanam Te. Let the Shastra be the Pramanam. Let the Shastra be the evidence. And for us, that means Bhagavatam primarily. Yeah.
Madhavacharya is quoted in Ratnavali.
It's quoted where?
Ratnavali 9.2.
Okay.
Okay, Prameya Ratnavali.
What's Ratnavali?
Prameya Ratnavali 9.2.
You said Ratnavali?
Yeah.
What is Ratnavali?
This is all the scripture, you know.
It's one scripture.
Yeah, but there it is quoted, Madhavacharya, you know, he gave emphasis on this, Shruti.
Shruti.
Yeah. And again, that to support that, in Madhyam Lila, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that the Vedic authority is the highest authority.
Yeah.
That's what he quoted.
Yeah.
So that whatever stated in Veda, we must accept. And for example, he gave conch shell and, you know, cow dung.
Yeah.
That's a bone and a stool.
Yeah.
Some living entities. But the Veda has accepted as it is most purity. So therefore, it must be accepted as purity.
Yes. See, if you use the word Veda, that's nice, because Veda is very broad. That can refer to it. But if you say Shruti, then that specifies the type of Vedic literature we're talking about. So Madhavacharya may have said that that's nice. We won't, of course, contradict that. But Jiva Goswami says, for us, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, our understanding is that the Bhagavatam is the highest authority, and even higher authority in one sense than the Shruti itself. Or you can say it's an expansion of the Shruti. It's considered the fifth Veda and so on. So we say the Veda, that's nice, because that's all-inclusive. But if we say Shruti, because they're outside of our school of thought, there are persons who think the Shruti is authoritative, whereas the Smriti is like, you can take it or leave it, but it's not very authoritative. And Jiva Goswami goes through pains to show that that is not the case, that the Puranas are actually the word Purana, he says the word Purana means Purna, that it completes the Shruti. Purna means complete. So he says the word Purana means that it completes the Shruti. And therefore offers a more complete understanding. And then out of all the Puranas, he points us to Bhagavatam. So I'm just saying that because someone may get the idea that Shruti is highest authority and Smriti is, you know, a lower authority, but we don't have that type of understanding in the Gaudiya Vaishnava lineage. Our understanding is that the Puranas are as good as the Shruti, and of the Puranas, the Bhagavatam is topmost authority.
Now, let me clear that point.
Yeah.
Thing is, Shruti means to hear.
Yeah.
Before, when there is no literature is very unwritten, that time people were able to memorize, you know, that through hearing process.
Yeah.
And that's why also it is called, Veda is also known as Shruti.
Right.
You know,
yeah, so if you're using that the word Shruti in a broad sense, that's okay. Anything that's heard that is Vedic knowledge is Shruti. Well, sometimes Shruti is also used in a specific sense to say that that which is directly coming from the Lord himself, Narayana, whereas Smriti is that which is remembered. So therefore, Shruti is a higher authority than Smriti, because the Smriti has to be based on the Shruti. But Jiva Goswami wants to show that's not the complete picture. The Puranas are as good as the Shruti, and the Bhagavatam is the highest authority. So if you're using Shruti in a broad sense like that, it's okay. That makes sense.
Thank you, Guru. I was just I had a question. You mentioned that the soul is composed of faith.
Krishna mentions that.
That conviction is synonymous with faith. I was just recalling in the 13th chapter when Krishna is explaining the knowledge of the knower of the field in the field, part of what constitutes the field is convictions.
Yeah.
So I was just wanting to understand better the point of how this the soul is composed of faith. it seems like the faith is very flickering. It's very changing.
Well, there's divine faith, nirguna shraddha, which is actually coming from spiritual reality, or you can say it's inherent in the jiva. But of course, the jiva in the material world, his faith is colored by the three modes of nature. So that's what chapter 17 tries to demonstrate. So one's faith may be colored by the modes of material nature, and therefore it's subject to change and manipulation by the material energy. But wherever you, again, I explained the best way I could, wherever you see movement, you can understand shraddha. Like people are running off to work right now. Why are they running off to work? That itself is an indication of something of their type of conviction, just by seeing them running off to work. Whereas you see another guy, he's also supposed to get on the same train, and he's walking calmly eating an apple. Then you can understand something about his particular level of shraddha. Everyone else is running, they're getting cramps, you know, they're tripping, and the other guy is just peacefully walking, eating an apple. And at that rate, he's definitely going to miss a train. So you can understand something about the different levels of shraddha or conviction. So by looking at the movement of entities, their shraddha is indicated indirectly in a lot of ways. Of course, when you're dealing with divine faith, you can't always tell, because like anything spiritual, you can't fully understand just by an external analysis what's going on. Just like Arjuna fighting in the war, for example, faith is synonymous with Sharanagati. If you were like a third party looking from a distance, and with binoculars, let's say, you see Arjuna come into the middle of the battlefield with Krishna. They sit there for about 45 minutes or so, and then you see him go back and fight the war. So from a third-party perspective like that, nothing happened. You know, nothing was going on. They went in the middle, kind of talked for a little bit, went back. But actually, a lot of things took place. Namely, his surrender took place in that short little exchange there. And although externally it manifested as him fighting the war, so you just might think he's just being a dutiful person. It has nothing to do with spiritual. He's just being dutiful. But actually, his fighting the war was based on a deep spirituality, namely his surrender to Krishna. So like anything transcendental, you can't always make out just by looking. But in the general sense, at least within ourselves, we can understand something of our faith by our movement, how we're moving. For example, how we chant our japa, or how do we not chant our japa? You know, when it's time for chanting, how do we get distracted? That is itself indicative of something of our faith. When it's time for doing japa or doing kirtan or doing service of any kind to Krishna, we find something else somehow comes up that's more important than that particular activity. That is itself somewhat indicative of our particular shraddha. And although we may not like to admit that sometimes, but that's a fact. That's the reality. You know, and it will surprise you as it surprised me that Jiva Goswami, there's a series of verses in the Bhagavatam, 11th canto, 11th chapter, I think starting with verse 29, that gives a long list of amazing qualities of a devotee. Just exquisite. When you read these qualities, you understand, this is a pure devotee of the Lord. And then it's the very next verse after that speaks about another type of devotee who's considered the best, even higher than his previous devotee, even though he doesn't have, at least externally, any of these qualities. But due to his faith in Krishna being of such a profound nature, even though he doesn't possess any of these qualities, he's considered an even higher practitioner than the previous devotee we hear about. It would be nice to go through those verses. I'm not going to go through them now. You can see them later. I can read it to you later. But that was very striking. In fact, when I was reading this verse to Sri Gauranga Prabhu one time at dinner table, I was reading this to him. And it was like a long list, about 36 or 26 qualities, long list. And he was hearing them. And then I said, this is the neophyte devotee. And he almost lost his prasadam. He was like, what do you mean the neophyte devotee? And then I mentioned the next devotee not having any of these qualities extensively, but having shraddha and pure surrender, he's considered higher. So wherever you see movement, you can understand something of shraddha, their type of shraddha. In the material sense, you can really understand sattva-guna, rajaguna, tamaguna. And within ourselves, we can understand something of our faith. Within others, we may not be able to perfectly tell, because if it's a transcendental faith, it may not always be obvious in terms of their activities. Although generally, if you're dealing with less advanced devotees, then they're also under the gunas, and so you can see something of their fate. Just like you hear something like this about, Prabhupada said that on one planet, there was a large mango, and it hit one of the jagged rocks on the moon or something, and then it created an ocean of mango juice. Now, you can understand where your faith is, and you hear, what? What? You know, I'm not going to share that point with anyone, you know, like that. And the other person's like, okay, no problem, you know, it's perfly okay with them. I come into the temple, I remember having this experience where I asked, who are these personalities on the altar? I probably said things, I probably didn't say personalities. What are these things on the altar? And someone said, that's God, you know, and I was like, oh, okay. I wouldn't say my faith was transcendental, but the type of devotees I associated with, and of course within Prabhupada's books, it was so convincing that I was like, there may be many things I can't understand. So they were like, that's God, okay, and, you know, it was no problem. Whereas the other person, they have a really hard time with the deities, especially if they grew up in like a Christian background or a Middle Eastern tradition where it's like no idol worship, you do idol worship, you go to hell and all these things. So they like everything about Christian consciousness, but the deities is like, that is really tough. They have a hard time offering obeisances, worshiping. They see Prabhupada's murti, it kind of like irritates their heart a little bit, you know, why are we worshiping a man as God? And like that, you can see something about the faith is indicated by that their movement or non-movement. Where there's suspicion, there's suspension. And where there's faith, there's movement. That's an easy way of thinking of that verse.
Thanks. I have a few other questions, but I'll see if anyone else, any other time, does anyone else have it?
No, they probably don't. Om. Yeah, let's go.
The next thing I was just, I was thinking how in this particular chapter that you're mentioning faith in the Vedas and the devotee, or he who represents the Vedas. So sometimes we see that such sections of scripture are interpreted or understood in various ways. For example, on the whole topic of astronomy, we see many different authorities in ISKCON in this field, and they have quite differing opinions. I just got into it a little bit, but some of our Goswamis are explaining this, everything in the Vedas needs to be accepted as it is. This is the means of this. Others are saying, well, we accept the Vedas, but considering in terms of the modern light of things and research that's proven, you know, materially, we can understand it in this way. No. Others may say that, well, perhaps there was some, you know, adjustment made in a certain calculation. So then there can be a different consensus. There's not a clear consensus. So is it up to the individual?
Hare Krishna, can you please? They're not going to pay attention, but you can just request them as nicely as possible.
So then is it up to the individual then to decide, well, this seems more
accurate than that? Well, I think that helps to demonstrate exactly what we're reading about today, that no one can perfectly explain it. Sukadeva Goswami is himself admitting that he cannot perfectly explain it, which means that it probably can't be perfectly understood. If there is no perfect explanation, how can there be a perfect understanding? So I think this type of bewilderment that's going on, even amongst our devotees, is just a self-evidence of exactly what we're hearing about today. That the material energy, like the spiritual reality, is ultimately incomprehensible. And our business is actually get out of the material world. So I'm sure our devotees, they're trying to put this together because it was wanted by Srila Prabhupada. Although if they're not able to come to a consensus about it, it's going to be hard to bring others to be convinced about these various realities if there's so much disparity even amongst our devotees. I don't have an opinion on that so far because they're trying to fulfill the desire of Prabhupada, so I can't say much about that. I mean, I do have an opinion, one I would not express in open arena. But in general, I would probably say consciousness is kind of our strong point. Because it's the only thing for centuries that's totally phantomless for the modern world. Although they're trying to explain it in terms of matter, they've not been able to demonstrate that even close close to demonstrating that consciousness is something of matter. There's a new type of materialist. They call themselves their concept is called emergentism. So they accept that the consciousness is something ontologically different from matter, as we do, but they still think that it emerged from matter somehow or other. And they have an idea that something can emerge from matter that can be ontologically different from matter. They have such a concept. And such a concept is a step closer, in one sense, to the spiritual idea. Ultimately, it doesn't satisfy our understanding at all. So I think these types of confusions and contradictions itself proves the point that it's ultimately incomprehensible. Therefore, our business is not to understand Maya perfectly, but to understand it enough to get out. This is mentioned by Krishna to Uddhava in the end of chapter 11.
Can I just conclude one comment? I just thought it was funny because you're mentioning on the point of quoting the authority. This is our principle. So I was with my sister and her husband, Scott, you might know him. Anyway, I was helping him move in, and he had this desk that had like legs like 4 feet tall. It was a desk where you stand, but we couldn't fit it through the door because it had these huge legs.
A desk where you stand.
It's a standing desk. So I was like, do you really need this thing? Like, what are you going to stand and do your work? I mean, come on, let's just... And just immediately he said, come on, Benjamin Franklin had one of these. So it's just funny because I was thinking in my mind, he's quoting the authority. He's quoting, he's giving the reference
yes,
here, the Mahajans.
Yes. Material.
So whatever, you know, people respect,
yes,
then that becomes their standard.
Yeah, that's right. There's a purport like that from Srila Prabhupada in the sixth canto. Everyone's got their different types of Mahajans, you know? And people, although they ultimately say they have no faith in authority, when you debate them, if you have a debate with a lot of them, they'll be quoting so many persons. Richard Dawkins says this, he said that, this one said this, you know, Hume is a favorite one of the atheists. They quote David Hume said this, and so you can see. And then we're saying, if you see Signs of Civilization when Prabhupada's having a discussion with one particular scholar about the word, about singing the names of God. So this one scholar said, there's nowhere mentioned in the Gita about singing the names of God. And Prabhupada says, no, Satatam Kirtanyantamam. And then he says, well, kirtan can mean, and they go back and forth in a few exchanges. And finally, Prabhupada says, we're drawing our authority from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And you're drawing your authority from, he mentioned somewhere else. So because there's a difference of opinion of who is the actual authority, ultimately there can be no consensus. So we have our faith in our certain authorities, and that will help us to advance like that. Yeah. Oh, it's...
I was wondering if you might be able to speak a little bit about the example of Dhruva Maharaj and how he had faith in Narada Muni, and so we see he followed Narada Muni's instructions, but when Narada Muni first offered him something, Dhruva said no.
Shraddha doesn't mean there should be no questions. Pranipatana Sevaya, right? Three things should be there that will help us to, which form the perfect combination for evolvement, as Prabhupada puts it in the purport. There should be surrender, there should be inquiry, and there should be service. In fact, inquiry marks the real surrender of the disciple. Tasma gurum prapadyeta jignasu shreya uttama. To the degree he's inquiring about how he can reach his highest potential as living entity, to that degree it can be understood that he's really taking shelter of the guru. He's seriously inquisitive about that. So just because one may have faith doesn't mean there should be no question. It doesn't mean there's not going to be any doubts. Arjuna says, Shishashteham Shadimam Twam Prapana. I'm a soul surrender unto you, indicating his faith in Krishna now as an authority. You please instruct me. And then two verses later, he says, I'm not going to fight. You know, he just lays it out, I'm not gonna fight. Although he just said he's surrendering to Krishna. So the idea is there, prapadna, means I'm ready to move forward and understand, hearing from you as an authority. But as Krishna's explaining, he has his doubts, and then Krishna has to remove the doubts. So then the quality of the spiritual master is what? Shalda pure chanishnatam brahmani upashamashram. The side of disciples, he should be inquisitive about his highest welfare. And the guru, shabda pure means Krishna, and shabda means the sound. So he should be thoroughly learned in the sound vibration coming from the Supreme Lord. That means the shastra. And as Prabhupada says, so much so that he can remove the doubts of his disciples based on the strength of his understanding of Shraddha. Now, if the disciples have no faith in Shastra, then they can't be helped. They can't be helped because the Guru will quote the Shastra to eradicate the doubts. So if they have no faith in the Shastra, then they can't actually be helped. So that means the problem is with them. But to the degree they actually do have faith in the Shastra, then the Guru has to demonstrate his understanding of the Shastra, how to apply it circumstantially and so on, and be able to remove the doubts of his disciples. So just because Dhruva Maharaj he's got faith in Narada Muni doesn't mean he isn't going to have doubts and isn't going to need an adjustment according to where he's at in his consciousness. So he presents that, and Narada gives him some understanding like that. Anything else? Okay, then. Om Tat Sat. Thanks a lot. Hare Krishna. Understand, Mr. Shan? Faithless. I do. I'm not every day. Let me see. I might help because I didn't get much rest because I'm trying to get up early so I can do my saver early because everyone